Welcome to the Mind Blown Podcast, where curiosity leads and discoveries follow. I'm Melanie Avalon, biohacker, author, and health influencer. And I'm joined by Scott Immens, entrepreneur, health enthusiast, and seeker of the unknown. Together, we're here to take you on a journey to the very edges of science, technology, philosophy, history, and beyond. Did you know in the minute it takes to introduce this podcast, around 6 million Google searches will be conducted, and at the end of 90 minutes, the space station will have orbited completely around Earth? Did you know when you shuffle a deck of cards, chances are that combination has never been created before? Also, according to Einstein's theory of relativity, time doesn't pass at the same speed for everyone, depending on how fast you're moving. Or how about the idea of quantum superposition? That's that particles can actually be two places at once. So is this actually happening right here, right now? One last fun fact that actually inspired the genesis of this show. If you remember Tinkerbell dotting the I in the Walt Disney logo, that never happened. So on that note, get ready for our adventure on today's Mind Blown Podcast. Welcome back, cognitive connoisseurs, synapse surfers, and epiphany enthusiasts to the Mind Blown Podcast. I'm Melanie Avalon. I'm here with Scott Immens. Scott, how are you today?
I am doing great. My son came to visit me here at the beach, and my daughter's having her 23rd birthday party with a friend from Sweden and a few of her other friends. So it's been a really good few days. A lot of company, a little stress, but more fun than stress, but a lot of fun. I'm a little sunburnt, but other than that, great.
Happy birthday to her. I wish I was turning 23.
Right.
That'd be nice.
Wouldn't it?
Oh my goodness. Well, do you have a mind-blowing fact to start us off with?
I do. It involves animals. I had heard this, I don't want to call it a rumor, but I'd heard this information and I'm like, I wonder if that's true. So I looked it up and sure enough, it's true. So did you know that the militaries around the world since 1917, World War I, have been using animals as both weapons and underwater detections, primarily Russia and the U.S., using dolphins to both scan for enemy ships using sonar, their own sonar, locate them. And then in the case of the Russians, they strapped bombs to said dolphins and collided them in two ships.
That's horrible. That's so sad. I didn't want it. Dolphins?
Dolphins. And the worst part is there are still countries in this current year using dolphins in warfare. Now, they're not using them as bombs, thank God. But they are. Do you remember that movie Deep Sea where they injected the shark's brain to make it smarter?
I did not watch that one.
So they're doing that with the dolphins. They're trying to make the dolphins smarter so that they can use biometric telemetry sensors for various things and train them to do more complex things. So that'll be, you know, what could possibly go wrong with that?
Oh my goodness. This is kind of like, did you see the horror movie of the year, Weapons?
No, someone, I think it was you mentioned it to me and I...
Did I?
I think you did. It's in my queue, but I don't know what it's about. I just...
You have to go see it. It's at the theater.
That's what we were talking about, going to the theater. You brought that one up.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to give spoilers away, but Weapons is the title. That's really sad. I don't like, that's a Debbie Downer of a fact.
Let's not base it on the emotional downness of it. Because it was only the one country using them as bombs.
Okay. I did not know that. It was really kind of a cute fun fact at the beginning because I could see like the dolphins, like they're smart.
Yeah, actually, they were very effective in protecting certain waterways in the U.S. during World War II. Super effective, actually.
I would give that a solid. Interesting that I didn't know that. Like, interesting that they don't talk about that anywhere. Like, I feel like that would be in the history books.
No, it's one of those things I told. Like, I had just kind of heard it in passing, and I'm like, I feel like that's true. And then I looked it up and found a whole bunch of countries doing a whole bunch of things with seals, otters, and whales.
I'll give it a solid 7.8.
Oh, I was hoping at least for an 8 on that one.
You can have an 8.
All right. Because I found it fascinating.
It is really fascinating. It doesn't surprise me, though. That's why it's not as mind-blowing to me. Like, now that I know it, I'm like, okay.
Well, I think the mind-blowing part is that you didn't know, right? I think this will be a fact. So few people will be like, wow, I didn't know that either.
Okay, you can have an 8.1.
All right, I'll take it. 8.1. All right, Mel, what's your fact?
Mine's funny, I think. I think it's funny. So, you know the little, like, the sweetheart candy tart? The hearts at Valentine's Day with the phrases on them?
Yeah, I feel like you've mentioned this to me before.
I don't think so.
It was something about that they weren't initially meant for Valentine's Day or something?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, hit me.
Okay. Well, tell me if I've told you this before then. So, but you know what I'm talking about, right? Like those.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where it's like, kiss me, love me, marry me. Those hearts. So they were invented. 1866 is when the guy Daniel Chase started putting the sayings on the can on these candies, and the original ones were much larger. Do you guess what the first one said?
Something like, your heart is all mine.
That wouldn't be very mind-blowing.
No, but that's all I got.
Okay. First one said, married in white, you have chosen right.
Oh, you definitely have talked to me about these before. I don't remember that specific line, but yeah, my next guess was going to be that the things that they wrote were crazy.
Another one they wrote was, married in pink, he will take a drink.
Wait, what was that one?
And married in, there was married in white, you have chosen right, which I just find so problematic because, don't get me started, the patriarchy, let us have this virgin woman. And then another one was, married in pink, he will take a drink. I guess that's saying that if you marry a girl in pink, like you're dating the type of man that's going to have a fun time.
You're both not pure.
Yeah. Like maybe this isn't so much holy matrimony. And then another one was married in, this doesn't rhyme though. I married in sateen. Love will not be lasting. Married in satin. Love will not be lasting.
That's horrible.
And literally these were on the candies and people were all about it.
Well, I think it's a genius idea to put it on the candies, but so the facts are just those three crazy sayings.
The fact is that those hearts that we use that have like, kiss me, love me, marry me, originally were much bigger and had these really patriarchal, horrible sayings on them about marriage.
Mm. Okay. I'm going to look up those phrases. I want to know what they mean, but I mean, it doesn't, because it was 1800s, it's not quite as shocking, but I still think the origin of it kind of freaks me out. So on the freak out, it's like a 9. On the mind blown fact, I'm going to go with a 7.5.
I accept that. I think that's good. Okay. Well, on that note, before we jump into today's topic, we have this week's winner of my Avalon X Magnesium 8. Every single week, we pick a winner. This is the best magnesium on the market, friends. It has 8 different forms of magnesium. It comes in a glass bottle, no problematic fillers. Most people are deficient in magnesium, so it will help things like your sleep, your energy, your mood, your muscle recovery, your digestion, all the things. And to enter to win, you can just write a brief review of the show on Apple Podcasts. And each week, we pick a winner. So this week's winner is Darian Murphy. 200,000, or alternatively, Darian Murphy 2 followed by 5 zeros. The title is Mind Blown is Awesome. And Darian says, I love the content from this podcast. They are so fun and I always look forward to listening to them. Can't wait for more episodes. Super underrated, with the emoji with the starry eyes, like the star eyes.
Well, that's a nice review.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Darian Murphy. 200,000. Please take a picture of your review in your podcast app, your Apple app, and send it to contact@mindblownshow.com. And we will send you a bottle of Avalon X Magnesium 8. Everybody else, you can write a review to be entered to win as well. And you can also use the code mindblown at avalonx.us on any of my products. We have another magnesium for the brain. We have berberine for blood sugar control, serrapeptase for inflammation and sinuses and allergies, and spirulina, and more to come. Hi, friends. If you've been wanting to try my Avalon X Spirulina or are already obsessed like me and want a portable, travel-friendly version, we now have a mini size available. I am so excited about this. I am obsessed with spirulina because it is one of the most nutrient-dense foods on the planet. In fact, it is so nutrient-dense that NASA worked with it to help support the nutrition of the astronauts in space. It is a powerhouse. We're talking a complete vegan protein where a serving contains 625% of your daily vitamin B12. Yes, vegan B12, over 1500% of your daily vitamin A, 100% of your hard-to-get vitamin K, and over half of your daily iron. And it's not just that. It also contains potent longevity compounds, things like glutathione, superoxide dismutase, CoQ10, GLA, and so much more. It's almost shocking how incredible spirulina is for your body. So much of our health and longevity involves meeting our nutrient status, and spirulina can help you do that. It supports energy, immunity, even beauty and detox. It took a long time to develop our spirulina because I was obsessive with getting the purest, highest quality spirulina out there. I searched high and low and found the perfect version of spirulina. It comes from the pristine, clean waters of Hawaii, from an extremely environmentally sustainable production facility, and it is purity tested to the max. Not only is it tested by the facility, we third-party tested it for over 70 pesticides, as well as heavy metals and mold. And the new mini version is so cute, so it's an amazing way to try it if you haven't tried it, or if you want to buy a smaller order, or if you want to travel with it, it's the way to go. It comes in beautiful glass bottles to help prevent leaching of plastics into ourselves and the environment. And by the way, it tastes amazing. Yes, I tasted so many different ones. You can get spirulina, including the large bag and this new mini size, at avalonx.us. Use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off. And you can get text updates when you text AvalonX to 877-861-8318. And doing that will get you a one-time 20% off coupon code. You can also get email list updates at avalonx.us/email list. I can't wait for you guys to try this spirulina. Grab the mini version now. Use the coupon code MelanieAvalon for 10% off at avalonx.us. Shall we jump into today's topic?
Let's do it. I'm excited.
So today is part three of our triangle series. We've been doing all of the mysterious triangles in the world, or some of them.
Thus completing the mind-blown triangle.
Yes. Oh, yeah. This is so perfect that we did three episodes. How perfect. Oh my goodness. And we're ending with the most famous one. And I wanted to tackle this one because I've been fascinated with this topic. This is like one of the topics. So like when growing up, I was always interested in all these weird topics. And my favorites were always like ghosts, crop circles, Bermuda Triangle, UFOs, Bigfoot. I feel like that would be like the five. I did that just like really, I just said that really fast, but I think that would be my five that I was like obsessed with. How about you?
Of all the episodes we've done?
No. Growing up, like, or topics that you were interested in.
Bermuda Triangle, crop circles, alien abductions, Bigfoot for sure.
So my five were Bigfoot, crop circles, ghosts, UFOs, and Bermuda Triangle.
All right. So mine are Bigfoot, crop circles, aliens and alien abductions, time warps and weird time things that are inexplainable, and the paranormal.
Awesome. Okay. So the point is that today's episode is Bermuda Triangle, and I was a little bit, I actually hadn't revisited it though since probably, like high school, like when I was really into all this stuff. It had been a while. It was nice to come to it with a kind of fresh perspective. I'm really curious where we're going to land on what we think is happening here.
Well, me too, because I haven't researched the Bermuda Triangle in a decade or more. Like, I was into it in my 20s maybe, and it's probably been 2 decades since I've really looked into it. So this will be fresh for me too.
What I think is important to note is, because people think Bermuda Triangle, at least for me, I think Bermuda Triangle, and I think, oh, all these planes are disappearing and boats are disappearing like all the time. It's actually numbers-wise, and if you plot like paths of planes and boats, it's not any more significant for the number of disappearances.
I've read that, but I don't like that. It's boring.
Well, but the ones that we know about are just like so weird that, and there are a lot. I'll give the stats, but.
So what you're saying is the numbers aren't so much different, but the way in which it happens is more bizarre.
Yes. But there have been a lot. So it's a 500,000 square mile triangle between Miami, Bermuda, and Puerto Rico. It's also called the Devil's Triangle. And so in general, more than 50 ships and 20 planes have reportedly vanished. At least 1,000 people have died there in the last 100 years, which is a lot. And also, apparently, it's not any more than if you take into account how many routes go through there.
And again, that is true. And again, Melanie, with the devil's nickname, like how often is it we talk about these weird paranormal places and they have like the devil's den, the devil's triangle, and sometimes that's the official name of the place. Seems like it comes up a lot in these weird, mysterious places.
This is true. Although the naming of this was not, a lot of times with those things, it's like named by like the natives and like it's, you know, this was named that relatively recently. But okay, so I can go, I think the best approach is I'll talk about the most famous case that kind of got this going, like kind of got this idea out there. And then I can kind of look at other things chronologically that have happened.
Cool. I like that idea.
Cool. Although I will say, actually, the first thing I'll say is Christopher Columbus apparently did experience stuff.
Is that where he saw the UFO or the light?
Yeah. So it was in 1492. Columbus sailed the ocean blue. So on his first voyage, he recorded strange compass behavior. And he said that they saw a glowing light rising from the sea.
That's interesting.
That's interesting. Okay, so the most famous case is known as Flight 19. And this was December 5th, 1945. And this really is wild because not only did the group of planes disappear, which I'm going to talk about, it was 5 Avenger bombers, 14 men total. It was a training flight.
I know this case, yeah.
They all disappeared. And the plane that went looking for them later or after disappeared too, which is very weird.
Wow. That's weird.
Yeah. So what happened, and what's really interesting is this was actually a dead reckoning navigation exercise. So the purpose of the test of what they were doing was involved their ability to like find their position without instruments. And that's what ended up happening. Their instruments started going crazy. But the lead pilot was Lieutenant Charles Taylor. And he had about 2,500 flying hours up until this point, mostly in this type of aircraft. And his trainee pilots had 300 total hours and 60 flight hours specifically in the Avenger that they were flying. And Taylor, apparently before it was like going to happen, he went and said that he had a bad feeling about the flight, which I find really interesting because I guess after we listened to all this, if he went into this with that mindset, playing devil's advocate, maybe he was, you know, psychologically going through something. I don't know.
I tend to always lean on the side that the time is a loop and we're tapped into that on a quantum level or subconscious level somehow. And that's that feeling. I don't discount what you're saying though, because a negative attitude can lead to negative outcomes. But that's come up on a couple of our other episodes. Remember the Titanic episode where the one guy had that bad feeling and just turned away and gave his very expensive ticket up and went home to his grandma and grandpa who were like, what, are you crazy? We paid a fortune for that ticket.
Okay, friends, I have some mind-blowing and scary facts about your skincare and makeup. Did you know that there's essentially no regulation of skincare and makeup in the US and that most skincare and makeup products are high in endocrine disruptors, which mess with your hormones? These are compounds which are linked to hormonal disruption, thyroid issues, fertility issues, autoimmune conditions, and even cancer. And they are rampant in our skincare and makeup. That's right. When you're putting on that skincare and makeup to supposedly support your skin and help it look better, you actually could be doing damage to your skin and your body and your health. It is a massive problem today. And ladies, if you're thinking of having children, these compounds actually pass through the placenta into the newborn, setting up our children with a toxic burden from birth. And these compounds can last in our system for years and years. In one study, testing conventional lipsticks, for example, most were found to be high in lead. And the half-life of lead is up to 30 years. That means when you put on some conventional lipstick, 30 years later, Maybe half of that lead has left your bones. There's also a legal loophole from the 1960s where companies can put whatever they want in products and don't have to tell you what it is. They just put it under the label fragrance. This is why safe skincare and makeup is so important to me, and I am so passionate about a company called Crunchy. Their standards are impeccable. Crunchy products contain no toxic ingredients, which they define as any ingredient known to cause harm or health hazard based on available ingredient data and research. Each ingredient actually undergoes a 30-step screening criteria for safety. All the products are gluten-free, with third-party lab testing comparable to food standards. A ton of their products are non-GMO, just look for the badge on their website, and all of their products are vegan, except for their lip oil, which contains organic beeswax from humanely sourced regenerative beekeeping. All of their products are also Leaping Bunny certified cruelty-free with no animal testing and made in the USA, with the exception of wooden pencils and accessories, which are made in American-owned factories in Germany with extremely high social, ethical, and environmental standards. And they use sustainable and environmentally conscious packaging with no plastic for primary packaging. Their products are also incredible. They make, hands down, the best mascara I have ever tried. Their Golden Light Multi-Peptide Facial Serum will make your skin glow. They also have an incredible Daylight Facial Cream and Nightlight Facial Cream, and an awesome makeup cleansing balm. You can check out their foundation as well, and their incredible sunscreen products. If you want safe sunscreen, you've got to try Crunchy. You can shop with me at crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon. That's crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon. And new customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off eligible orders. New customers with me will also receive a gift from me after your first purchase. So again, for the ultimate in safe skincare and beauty, go to crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon and use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 for 10% off, as well as a free gift from me. For all the latest discounts, specials, and announcements from me in the world of safe skincare and clean beauty, definitely get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. For all the latest text updates, just text skincare, one word, to 877-861-8318. That's the word skincare to 877-861-8318. Basically what ends up happening, and I can tell you the actual transmissions if you want to hear them, because I think it's really, I can read them. But what ended up happening before I do it, just so you get an idea, is they were flying over the Atlantic for whatever reason, Taylor saw that their compasses stopped working. Taylor saw islands below them where there shouldn't have been islands. He thought they were in the Gulf. The Gulf of Mexico. So while he needed to turn to get back home, he needed to go west. He told everybody to go east because he thought that was the way to get to land. And instead, they were flying in the Atlantic, apparently.
So he made a mistake, or his compass was malfunctioning?
So basically what happened, what we have from the recordings, is they had a practice bombing operation that they were doing. They had carried it out. We know that that was completed. Because at 15 minutes, a pilot requested and was given permission to drop his last bomb. 40 minutes later, another flight instructor, Lieutenant Robert F. Cox, in an FT-74, he was forming up with his group of students for the same mission. So they're about to do this after these guys do it. He received an unidentified transmission. And so this is where the transmission starts. So one of the crew members from the Flight 19 group asked another person in the group, whose name was Powers, for his compass reading. Powers said, "I don't know where we are. We must have got lost after that last turn." So then Cox, who's the flight instructor who's going to go out after them, said, "This is FT-74, plane or boat, calling Powers. Please identify yourself so someone can help you." So after a few moments, there was a response, and it was a request from others in the flight for suggestions. So they were asking for suggestions of what to do. The FT-74, Cox, he tried again. And a man identified as FT-28, who's Taylor, so that the captain that we've been talking about, Taylor, he comes on. So Taylor identifies himself. So then they say to him, FT-28, this is FT-74, what is your trouble? And then he replied, "Both of my compasses are out, and I am trying to find Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I am over land, but it's broken. I am sure I'm in the Keys, but I don't know how far down, and I don't know how to get to Fort Lauderdale." So this is where he's saying that he's in the Keys, and like that just doesn't line up with where they were supposed to be. So Cox, FT-74, he informed the NSA that the aircraft was lost, and he told Taylor to put the sun on his port wing and fly north up the coast to Fort Lauderdale. Base operations then asked if the flight leader's aircraft was equipped with a standard transmitter, which could be used to triangulate the flight's position, but the message was not acknowledged by them. Instead, they said, quote, "We are heading 30 degrees for 45 minutes. Then we will fly north to make sure we are not over the Gulf of Mexico. During this time, no bearings could be made on the flight and IFF could not be picked up." Taylor was told to broadcast on a different transmission. That order was not acknowledged, so he was asked to switch to another transmission, which was the search and rescue frequency. And he replied, "I cannot switch frequencies. I must keep my planes intact." And then at 16:56, Taylor was again asked to turn on his transmitter. He didn't acknowledge it. A few minutes later, he advised that his flight change course to 90 degrees due east for 10 minutes. About the same time, okay, so basically he's thinking they need to go east to get back to land, but that makes no sense based on where they technically were. They should be going west to get to land. So around the same time, someone on the flight said, "If we could just fly west, we would get home, head west." So basically some of the students in his group presumably did know that they were over the Atlantic. And people question now, like, why didn't they just go west on their own if they knew that that's what they should have done? But it probably had to do with military discipline. They were following their leader. So yeah, so none of the planes, even though there was, you know, multiple planes, they all followed Taylor in his command to fly east.
But he did say on the mic, "We should. Why don't we fly west?" Then there was no response to that.
They could hear another student say that.
But yeah, but no one else acknowledged it. Like the captain didn't say, "No, we're going east." Or
I only have this transmission, so I don't know what else was said.
Yeah, because I remember this is all coming back to me now, because this particular story I did research like a few years ago, and it's coming back to me. Keep going. This is super interesting.
Okay, so then it says the weather was deteriorating, radio contact became intermittent, and it was believed that the five aircraft by this point were more than 230 miles out to sea east of the Florida Peninsula. That's where we think they were. Taylor radioed, quote, "We'll fly 270 degrees west until landfall or running out of gas." And then he requested a weather check at 1724. By 1750, several land-based radio stations had triangulated Flight 19's position as being within a 120-mile radius of a certain area, which was 29 degrees north, 79 degrees west. So basically, it was north of the Bahamas and well off the coast of Central Florida, not where Taylor thought they were. At 1804, Taylor radioed to his flight, and he said, "Holding 270, we didn't fly far enough east. We may as well just turn around and fly east again." By that time, the weather had deteriorated even more and the sun had set. And then around 1820, his last message was received. And he was heard saying, "All planes close up tight will have to ditch unless landfall. When the first plane drops below 10 gallons, we all go down together."
You know, this almost sounds like he was... It almost seems like he was deliberately trying to down them, but I don't think that's the case. But the fact that he's making them go east, continue to go east, and then like, "Yeah, we're running low on fuel. Let's keep going east." Ignore the west comment. It's a little weird.
So again, the west comment, there was multiple planes and they were hearing the transmitter. So I don't know that he was like in the plane with the student that said, "We need to go west." It sounds like some of the students...
an intraplane communication, so it wasn't being broadcast necessarily to him.
I think they were getting multiple different from the whole group. They were getting different messages. So the point is some of the students thought they should be going west, but he was saying they needed to go east. But before that, they were saying that their equipment wasn't working, that they saw that the ocean looked wrong. Their odometers showed impossible readings. They said that they saw islands, but where they supposedly were, there weren't any islands. And then, yeah. And so then all five planes just completely disappeared. But what's interesting about that is, so if they were where, like home, like where we thought they were, why couldn't we find them? Because the rescue mission that came after that, so then there was a search and rescue plane. It had 13 crew members on it, and it also completely vanished.
And this is a lot like the Alaska Triangle, where they knew the speed, the direction, and the altitude of the planes, and then even through those massive manhunts, couldn't find any shred of where they were. And you should be able to land those planes in the ocean and survive it.
The conclusion of the search and rescue plane, so they never found the five planes, they never found nothing. The search and rescue plane, some witnesses said they saw an explosion. So the conclusion was that it exploded midair. But then it's like, why couldn't they find it then? You know, like, why couldn't they find any of these planes? The Navy, what they said was it was navigational errors on the part of Taylor. But it's very weird that the compasses failed on all of the flights. Because if the students, if they had concretely known to go west, then maybe they would have, even though Taylor was saying go east, but none of their compasses were working. But they knew in their head that they were over the Atlantic and that they needed to go east. Sorry, needed to go west to get to land.
Yeah, I'm tracking.
So this is the event that became sensationalized. And so in a Fate magazine article in 1952, there was an article called Sea Mystery at Our Back Door, and it laid out the triangle, and it talked about a few different disappearances, including this one. This is like the big one that people, you know, think about the most. But like I said, there are some others. So 1844, we have a HMS Atlanta. Yes, Atlanta. So this ship was originally launched in 1844, and then the disappearance event happened in 1880. It was a training ship, and she disappeared with her entire crew sailing from the Royal Naval Dockyard in Bermuda, going to Falmouth, England. And this is something where it's thought that that it probably sank in a powerful storm. But I guess it's not really that exciting, just that it disappeared and that they never found it. And they attributed it to the Bermuda Triangle.
So sunk, but they, or vanished, they don't know. Because there was a very famous ghost ship. I don't know if it's the Bermuda Triangle.
Yes, this is the ghost ship, the next one. I was getting it confused. So the ghost ship one is the USS Cyclops. And that was 1918. It was a 550-foot Navy freighter with 300 men and 11,000 tons of manganese. It vanished without a trace on a routine route. It was the largest non-combat loss in U.S. naval history. And it was last seen in Barbados on March 3rd.
And this was called the what ship? This was the Cyclops?
Mm-hmm, the USS Cyclops.
So not a ghost ship?
Not a ghost ship, no. Largest non-combat loss, though, in U.S. naval history.
Okay.
Now we're at the ghost ship. Okay, so we have these two ships that just completely disappeared. Now we have the 1919 Carol A. Deering ship. So 1919 is when it was launched. And then in late August 1920, it went on its voyage. It set sail from Virginia, and it was going to Brazil to deliver coal. The captain was William H. Merritt. He had to be replaced in Barbados, and the new captain was W.B. Warmell, who was a seasoned elderly man. So they left Rio to return in December 1920 to go back to the U.S. And on the way north, they made a stop in Barbados in January 1921. And the crew members were apparently complaining about this new captain guy, Warmell, and they were suggesting, and there were thoughts that maybe there was tension and potentially mutiny. And then this is when it disappears. So it disappears. And then on January 31st, 1921, it was spotted run aground on the Diamond Shoals near North Carolina, Cape Hatteras. It was completely abandoned. The lifeboats and the navigational equipment were missing. The galley looked like a meal had been prepared in a hurry, but never eaten. The personal belongings were left behind. And then they did, there was a letter.
I remember this one because of the meal that had been prepared and then like suddenly abandoned.
Yeah. Yeah. So it looked like they were like preparing a meal for the next day, but it was completely abandoned. On April 11th, 1921, a local fisherman claimed to have found a message in a bottle floating in the water. He gave it to the authorities and it said, "Deering captured by oil burning boat, something like chaser, taking off everything, handcuffing crew, crew hiding all over ship, no chance to make escape. Finder, please notify headquarters, Deering." Which, so that suggests that maybe it was like a pirate situation. And then later experts conclude it was forged, that this was a forged letter. The suspicion was if a crew member did manage to get hold of paper, pen, and a bottle and write a letter, why would he request that the company be notified as opposed to the police or the Coast Guard? So they think that maybe that letter was a forgery.
Or it was like Wayland Industries from Aliens, where they had really precious cargo that they couldn't give up.
Wait, what?
I'm saying maybe the cargo on that ship had to go to the company because it was illegal or contraband.
Or whatever, not the manganese, like something else on the ship.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, maybe it was something else. Is that, and also, is that the one that was towed back by someone and then the person that towed it back got in trouble? Or is that, am I thinking of a different one?
I don't see anything about that.
Yeah, it might be a different one.
It was just, ultimately it was destroyed because they said it was a hazard to navigation. So that's, I guess, the first like ghost ship situation in the Triangle. Some other ones, 1967, the SS Witchcraft ship. That was two men who were sailing to watch Christmas lights near Miami. And what's important is whatever they were sailing was supposed to be, quote, unsinkable. I don't know exactly why, but I don't think you should ever put that on a boat. That's like not a good idea. At 9:03 p.m., they radioed that they'd hit something, but they weren't in danger. And then at 9:19, they completely vanished. So only, you know, 16 minutes later. And despite the Coast Guard looked for them extensively, couldn't find anything. There was another ship called the Wasp in 1814. Oh, that was earlier. That one disappeared near Savannah.
By the way, I think if you name your boat Witchcraft, you're also asking for it.
Yeah, yeah. Or Cyclops.
Those are not great ship names.
Not the best. Those are like some of the big ones. I think the Flight 19 one is just so interesting because we were, you know, they were talking with the whole group. You know, like they were like talking through radio and theory knew where they should be in theory. So it's weird that all their compasses failed at the same time that they said they were seeing islands that shouldn't have been there if they were where they said they were, and that he so deliberately insisted that they fly the completely wrong direction to get home. And then they disappear and then we can't find any of them. And then also the plane that goes to look for them disappears. And we can't find that?
Think to me, the plane that vanishes, which is built for reconnaissance and long-range flights, that is what makes this case so crazy. Because those guys were dead reckoning, which takes some skill and talent, right? Because you're only allowed to use your compass and visuals and a few other crude instruments, which they train pilots to do in the event that the instruments go down, right? So you have to be able to dead reckon with basic instruments. But that's a hard thing to do. But the other one that goes after them is using all like the latest technology and radar and all of that. So for that to go down too is like particularly odd.
And it just, so like I said, they concluded that it just exploded mid because there people saw some sort of explosion. But even then, shouldn't you be able to find it then if we saw like an explosion?
Right. The pieces, maybe like the pieces.
Yeah.
Yep. The aliens apparently did not want the five original planes to be found. They were like, look, good effort. You know, we A for effort, but no, we're zapping you.
So speaking of aliens, some of the different theories here are, one is that there's just, well, a lot of the issues involve people having compass issues, including, like I said, like even Columbus, right? Like he was having issues. So it's something that maybe there's some local magnetic, you know, anomaly here that makes equipment mess up. And so planes and boats just get lost. That one makes a lot of sense to me. Oh, did you know that compasses actually normally have natural magnetic variation in relation to the poles, and that there are only a small number of places where magnetic compass north and geographic true north are exactly the same?
Yes, magnetic north drifts between 30 degrees off center and 10 degrees direct true north. So true north is the perfect north pole, and magnetic north is usually between 11 and 30 degrees off. It's currently 30 degrees off, and its pace of moving off has accelerated.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's almost more interesting that there's places that it's locked up. So there's a line running from Wisconsin to the Gulf of Mexico where it is matched up.
Yeah, that would make sense, right? Because you've got this, there's going to be a place where the magnetic pole is equal, you know, and other places where there's magnetic anomalies. But yeah, I think the compass is not the most reliable tool.
Yeah. So that's one explanation, is that there's just something here that makes compasses go really crazy. There is a theory of the Gulf Stream current. This is kind of like in Finding Nemo, I think.
Where the turtles like, ride this wave, man.
So it's like a river within an ocean. So it can and does carry floating objects. So if a small plane were to like land there, or a boat have engine trouble there, it could get carried away a lot further from, you know, where it supposedly was. So that's an option. It could just be weather. So it could be that there's a lot of hurricanes, a lot of storms. One interesting theory is called, it's the methane hydrate theory. And it's this idea that there are these large fields of methane on the continental shelves, and that it creates these bubbles that could, in theory, sink a ship by decreasing the density of the water. And then any wreckage it would either go to the bottom of the ocean floor, or it would get really rapidly dispersed by the Gulf Stream.
Yeah, that theory was pretty popular in the 90s. It makes sense for ships, right? Because the gas, of course, this giant bubble of air, you're going to sink immediately. But it doesn't really work all that well for planes.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. According to the USGS, no large releases of gas hydrates are believed to have occurred in the Bermuda Triangle for the past 15,000 years.
Okay, so we could scratch that theory off.
So it's more like theory that doesn't really manifest. And then the other theories would be things like what you were talking about, that aliens, that there could be a wormhole here that connects, you know, to different areas, like what messes up with time and space, all of that stuff.
I like the time and wormhole one. There's a case that can't be proven, but there's a guy who claims he was basically had to outfly like this storm cloud, and while they were in it, basically time stopped.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, but he like narrowly like made it to this like closing gap. It was like this, the portal was closing, and he like got through just in the nick of time, but had to do these crazy maneuvers. And it was him and his dad with the pilots, but it's only their word, so there's no really other evidence to that one.
So what do you think? Because I've listened to a lot of accounts of the Flight 19 situation. It's really interesting that the equipment failed on all the planes. It's also interesting, though, that Taylor was so insistent of going this other way, but some of the students seem to, you know, think differently. Because you mentioned something like, oh, it sounds like he's trying, you know, not that this is the case, but it could sound like he's trying to down the mission. We know he was like super nervous going into it, or had a bad feeling.
I'm going to say that that's probably not the case, because, again, the ship that went looking for him went missing, the plane rather. So even if that was his mission, like it's still weird, because the other one that went looking for them goes missing. And if they downed the planes, right, the students weren't going to like slam the planes into the ocean. They were going to try and land as flat as they could, which is possible to do with aircraft. And they might even float for some period of time. So they should have found either men or parts or something in the plane.
If we knew kind of like where they were.
And also, you know what's weird? So you send out only just one ship, like you didn't...
That was the plane that disappeared, but I think...
I did find this interesting anecdote on the magnetic field differentiation in the Bermuda Triangle. Now, apparently there have been studies that magnetic field is not disrupted. It's just the fact that people are, you know, misusing principles of navigation. However, there's evidence clearly state the presence of the Agnic line, which is the line you were talking about, within the triangle. The Agnic line is the real and character feature of the Earth's magnetic field. It's the line on the surface where true north and magnetic north, the direction of the compass points into, happen to align perfectly. On this line, magnetic declination, the angle of difference between true magnetic north and north, is zero as one moves away from the line, and this declination changes. For a trained navigator or sea, accounting for this declination is a fundamental part of calculating for the course and is not a mysterious force, but rather a varied principle. But I wonder how well they really knew that, you know, back then. Because, you know, they're all sort of believing that their compasses were broken. So maybe they weren't skilled in that. They weren't as knowledgeable about that line as they should have been.
Yeah. It looks like the full group that went after them, let's see, there was a consolidated PBY Catalina. So departed after 1800 to search for Flight 19 and guide them back if they could be located. After dark, two Martin PBM Mariner flying boats, originally scheduled for their own training flights, were diverted to perform square pattern searches in the area. U.S. Navy Squadron Training Number 4, this is the one that disappeared, PBM 5BUNO59225, took off at 1927 from Naval Air Station Banana River, called in a routine radio message at 1930, and was never heard from again. So quite a few groups went looking for them. That's the one that disappeared. At 2115, the tanker SS Gaines Mills, they're the ones that said that they saw flames from an explosion leaping 100 feet high and burning for 10 minutes at 28.59 degrees north, 80.25 degrees west. They looked for survivors through the pool of oil and aviation gasoline, but didn't find any. The escort carrier USS Solomons also reported losing radar contact with an aircraft at the same position and time. So it could have been a different plane that they found for the explosion. Or the same plane, I guess. I guess it could be either. The PBM could hold 9.83 tons of aviation gasoline. Its flexible fuel lines had a noted tendency to get loose in rough conditions and leak gasoline. Like, yikes.
So maybe that's not the plane you want to use.
Maybe we don't want to be flying that plane. And then there was a massive investigation in general. Let's see, a 500-page Navy Board of Investigation report published a few months later. They made a few different observations. They said their conclusion was that Taylor had mistakenly believed that the small islands he passed over were the Florida Keys, that his flight was over the Gulf of Mexico, and that heading northeast would take them to Florida. It was determined he had passed over the Bahamas as scheduled, and he did, in fact, lead his flight to the northeast over the Atlantic. The report noted that some subordinate officers did likely know their approximate position, as indicated by the radio transmissions stating that flying west would result in reaching the mainland. They also noted in the report that Taylor refused to change the radio training frequency to the search and rescue radio frequency, but they concluded Taylor was not at fault because the compasses stopped working, and then they concluded that the search and rescue plane was an explosion. And then later, they changed it to cause unknown.
Oh, well, isn't that the story of these stories?
After Taylor's mother contended that the Navy was unfairly blaming her son for the loss of 5 aircraft and 14 men, when the Navy had neither the bodies nor the airplanes.
Yeah, good for the mom.
Thrilling announcement, friends. My EMF blocking product line is finally here, and I'm going to tell you how you can get 10% off. Did you know that EMFs are considered a type 2B carcinogen by the IARC? They are linked to so many health issues, including headaches, migraines, fatigue, and even potential fertility issues. Thankfully, there are a lot of ways to reduce your exposure, and one of the best ways is to not use Bluetooth AirPods. And also, do not put your phone by your head. In fact, did you know that if you look in your iPhone, go to the legal section, and then RF exposure, Apple literally suggests that you use hands-free options like speakerphone, headphones, or other similar accessories to reduce your exposure to EMFs. Yes, it says this in your iPhone. And here's the other thing. Even wired headphones, being digital, can conduct EMFs into your head. That's why I made Avalon X EMF-free air tubes. They're basically like your normal wired headphones, but they turn into analog closer to your ear, so it stops transmission of EMFs into your head. I'm launching with black ones and rose gold. You can use adapters to make them fit any phone. And the reason this launch took so long, we're talking actually years, is because I was so neurotic on getting good sound quality. I cannot even tell you how many different prototypes I tried, but we finally have them, and you can get them now. Go to AvalonXEMF.us and use the code Melanie Avalon to get 10% off. That's AvalonXEMF.us with the coupon code Melanie Avalon to get 10% off. That link will actually redirect to my partner's website at Shield Your Body, and that coupon code Melanie Avalon will get you 10% off site-wide for all of their EMF blocking products, including my air tubes. AvalonXEMF.us with the coupon code Melanie Avalon for 10% off.
I have one really crazy story that I would love to cover. So you want to hear it?
Yes.
This one, I think, is in the really sort of paranormal slash mind blown category. And it's often not talked about. Like, you got to go looking for this one. So this is the Valentik disappearance. Pilot Frederick Valentik, a 20-year-old Australian with 150 total flight hours, which is decent, private pilot license. He was night rated, but didn't have a ton of time. Like 150 is a decent amount, but he was night rated, and you know, that's pretty impressive.
What does that mean?
Night rated means you have to go through a series of tests and hours flying at night with an instructor and get certified to fly at night, because there's different parameters and you have to rely more on your instruments, etc. He's in a single engine Cessna, which is a tiny little, you know, one of those like 4-seater to 2-seater planes that you see oftentimes depicted like in TV shows in remote areas. On Sunday, October 21st, 1978, he departed Moore Arban Airport from Melbourne at 18:19 local time for a 235-kilometer or about 110-mile hop to Kings Island, Tasmania, across a relatively rough, what they call the Bass Strait. He told officials he was collecting some friends. Collecting in Australia means picking up, in case you're wondering why he's saying collecting. He was collecting his friends and some, quote, crayfish on King Island. So King Island Airport had not been notified of his arrival. His request for landing lights and fuel and omission was later deemed unusual. Now, this is where it gets crazy, though. This is the last 6 minutes of his radio communication over the Bass Strait. At 19:06, 100 hours, while cruising at 4,500 feet over Bass Strait, Valentik radioed Melbourne Flight Service Officer Stephen Robbie Key, and here's his quote. Melbourne, this is Delta Sierra Juliet. Is there any known traffic below 5,000? Robbie. No, no known traffic. Valentik, seems to be a large aircraft playing some sort of game with me. It's flying over me 2 or 3 times, and it doesn't look like an aircraft. He then went on to describe it as a shiny metal surface with 4 bright green lights on the object's underside with erratic movements. Quote, it's orbiting on top of me, he exclaimed. It's stationary orbit, and it's just, and radio cuts out. Engine roughness. My engine is getting rough. It's idling rough. Then his last and final statement. It's still hovering rough, and this thing is not an aircraft. 17 seconds of loud metallic scraping noises followed with no voice over the radio transmission to Roby. Immediately after that, his plane vanishes from radar and he's never heard from again. Efforts from the Royal Air Force and civilian aircraft combined 1,000 square miles using 15 different aircraft from the Royal Air Force and over 100 aircraft, civilian aircraft. The outcome, Australia's Department of Transportation formally listed the cause of this unknown and concluded the Cessna probably ran out of fuel and ditched, but could not explain the radio exchange or absence of the wreckage. Now, that sounds like a cover-up. You're going to say he ditched the plane when he's telling you there's something circling over him and you hear like this large metallic grinding before he vanishes off radar?
That's weird.
So weird, right?
Why would you not say that there was probably another, I mean, doesn't sound like it was a plane, but wouldn't you say more likely there was like another plane involved or another something involved?
You think that would be like, there was another plane that actually we detected later. They probably had a near interaction and that cut out his engines due to lack of oxygen from the jet stream, from the military jet that flew overhead. They could have come up with something way better than he ran out of gas. Yeah. I mean, it was only a 100-mile trip. That plane has enough gas to go several hundred miles more than that. But what's just as wild is it just happened again, August 2025.
Oh, really?
Yeah. August 2nd, 2025, a two-seater Bristol SLSA aircraft carrying Greg Vanaw, 72, and Kim Warner, 66, along with their dog Molly, vanished after departing Georgetown Airport in Tasmania. The aircraft was bound for New South Wales, but never made it to its destination. Like many Bermuda Triangle cases, no distress signal or radio communication was received after takeoff. Despite intensive air and sea searches, no wreckage was found. And this just happened 20 days ago.
Wow. Yeah, it's almost, I mean, it's easier to write it off in the past because it's like, oh, maybe we weren't as, you know, capable of, I don't know, the equipment or searching, but when it happens now.
Yeah. Yeah. So now you've got a plane that's a 2025, you know, technology, which is GPS, dual radar communications back and forth, black box, emergency beacons, et cetera, and on, and it just up and goes missing.
The one devil's advocate thing is, if this were happening over land, that would be wild because it's like, how do we not find these crashes? Because it's over the ocean, it's a lot easier if you crash to just disappear.
Fair. But I'm going to give you one last piece of evidence for the 1972 or 82 case. Was it 82 or 70? I forget what year it was. The first case, the Victon case. In addition to his crazy radio transmissions, three eyewitnesses came forward. A plains farmer from Cape Otway reported seeing green light moving erratically in the sky roughly the same time as Valentech's call came in. A camping family on King Island recalled seeing an unusual green glow over the water that evening, assuming it was a meteor until news broke the next morning. An amateur astronomer in Melbourne logged a meteor that matched base's straight direction, and it said that he saw four discrete green lights, not a single streak. Although they're saying that at first he said it was a streak. But still, two people plus a family all seeing these green lights. And remember his quote about what he said. It had four green lights on the underside of the object. I'm going UFO on that one. Or military test plane.
Well, the interesting thing is, Columbus saw, you know, lights from the ocean.
Arising from the ocean, is that what he said? Yeah. And that's a very common theme in the UFO, because you know there's a whole thing called USOs, right? Undersea objects, unidentified sea objects.
Yeah, I remember the first time I heard that, I was like, that's wild. But the more you think about it, if you wanted to hide on the earth and you were like advanced technology, setting up shop under the ocean would probably be a nice place.
It'd be a fantastic spot. Their vessels are clearly completely vacuum sealed because they can take the rigors of high velocity space travel with a complete vacuum. So the pressures of the ocean are likely not going to affect them either. So to them, it's space or water. It's kind of the same thing. And they're not using rocket technology as far as we know. So they don't need, you know, they can just go down into the water, probably cruise in the water as easy as they can anywhere else. And then they're totally off radar.
Yeah, it's like literally the place to go. It's crazy how much of the ocean we, you know, have no idea about. Probably dinosaurs down there. Because, like, think about whatever would have been down there during whatever cataclysmic, you know, meteorites and things like that. I wonder if everything down at the bottom of the ocean just kind of survived.
It's possible. I wouldn't put it past this planet to have intelligent life under the ocean. It would not shock me.
So what are you putting if you had to pick what you think is happening?
I think there are two things happening in the Bermuda Triangle. I think that there are some magnetic anomalies due to that magnetic line. I definitely think that's probably one of the most likely scenarios. And I do think there is some sort of interdimensional, whether that's portals or whether that's both portals and beings coming through said portals or under the water. I think there's some technology being used against some of these aircraft for whatever reason. Because I have a hard time writing off all of these just completely vanished planes. The military one that you brought, and then the one from 1982, and then, or 70, I think it, actually, I'm sorry, it was 78. And then the one just literally a month ago, like just vanishing. And the way the guy described it, like his last 6 minutes of transmissions were pretty clear that he was being like attacked by something. He gave a pretty clear description of it. And then there were three corroborating witnesses that saw the green lights on the ground. I don't know what else that is. Like, what else could that be other than some interference? And we know that our own government has now finally, after a century, basically admitted, yeah, there's stuff in the sky and we don't know what it is. Now, they're still doing a massive cover-up as far as I'm concerned, but maybe that's for our own good. I don't know. You know, maybe it's our own technology that maybe it's like Lazar said, back engineering technology. But I definitely think there's either extraterrestrial beings and or beings under the sea that are involved or military technology. Something's going on that's weird. And I do think the magnetic thing's playing a role. I don't think the methane gas thing holds up. I think it's magnetic. And I think where there's these magnetic anomalies, there's also paranormal UFOs.
You pretty much took the words out of my mouth. I definitely think there's magnetic anomalies. I definitely think a lot of the things going down are, because I said at the beginning that there's been more than 1,000 people have died, more than 50 ships and more than 20 planes. Some of them most likely could be just, you know, got lost, magnetic problems, things like that. And we just never found the wreckage. It's super weird that there are these reports of like seeing weird things and things happening. And I agree as well that that could go both ways. It could be our technology. It could be aliens. When I was in high school, like obsessed with this, I thought it was a wormhole, like the vortex stuff that we were talking about and the magnetic anomalies.
I think that that could be a part of it. Because if you watch Skinwalker Ranch, a lot of what they're talking about are wormholes, and a lot of these UAPs that they're seeing in the air seemingly come from out of nowhere through what one could assume is a portal. So it could be that, but I think you were going in a different direction, right?
Like now you're saying I'm a different direction?
Yeah, you were saying it, like you just felt like it was these weird anomalous time portals that were gobbling things up, I think is the direction.
Yeah. And I just thought like the electromagnetic spectrum was like all messed up and there might be like wormholes. And so stuff just happens.
Does seem like though where there's these magnetic anomalies, there's also UFOs and weird vanishings and maybe portals. So maybe those things are all connected somehow.
Highly likely. Maybe that's where, like, when the spaceship aliens, maybe when they like arrive somewhere, it messes up the space in that area.
Oh, I think most certainly it does. And the,
like, maybe the Bermuda Triangle is their like airport, you know, like it's where they pop up.
So here's something really interesting. On that show, Skinwalker Ranch, which is a lot about this one section that they keep investigating called the Triangle, which is on the ranch. And when they launch rockets and balloons and drones with GPS technology, the GPS technology goes so wacky that it shows the drone 200 feet underground.
Oh, wow.
Or it'll show like, so the guy will be flying, like one time they flew a helicopter through it and his instrument said he was right over the spot. And from the ground, they're looking at him like, dude, you're 300 yards away. Like, you're not even close. And he's like, no, my instruments say I'm right over it. And they're like, no, you're not. So it was very interesting that every time these UAPs would show up or right before they showed up, their instruments and drones would either stop working, couldn't penetrate the drones, or just they would just shut off, or they would show this really bizarre GPS data that would literally show the whole thing going underground.
It's also kind of like the crop circles, you know, all the kind of messes up with equipment and stuff like that when you're in that area.
I've got an update for you on that.
What is that?
I was listening to this guy who is a known crop circle hoaxer, right? And he said that, yes, many of them are man-made. However, when you make them, things show up. So while it might be man-made, I have done this for a long time. And this guy is like super, like now controversial in the people that want to believe all crop circles are like, you know, from aliens. He's like, it doesn't matter which way it goes because you make these things and lights start showing up and weird craft appear. He's like, that happens about 60 to 70% of the times that we make these crop circles. And he said, the really strange part is we don't decide where we're going to make them. We just let our instincts guide us. And when we go against what our instincts initially told us, nothing ever shows up. But when we do it where we're supposed to, something shows up. And he gave an example of this one time where they went to the wrong field and they're like, all right, we got to go. Nothing's happening. Let's go to the other field. They went back to the correct field. And while they were doing it, they heard these girls chanting. Turns out the girls were chanting to have a UFO appear and for a crop circle to be made in their crop. So they made, they couldn't hear these girls because they were like a half a mile away in their house. They didn't find that out till later when they heard the girls on the news saying, yes, we were chanting and conducting like a manifestation connection ritual with the UFOs to try and get them to come and make a crop circle. And then they were talking about how happy they were that it happened.
That's weird.
Isn't that? And they were hearing the chanting while they were making the crop circle.
That makes me think it's like mind control stuff.
Maybe the aliens are like, hey, go make a crop circle here in this shape, and then we'll show up.
I'm just thinking it kind of makes me believe it less. I don't know, so who am I to say?
I know instinctually why, that because I felt that way at first too, but then I realized that Chris Bledsoe and his father talk about being able to, quote, summon UFOs. Another podcaster I know up in Canada from Grimerica named Graham has done what they call CET5, which is basically you meditate with a group of people and then try to bring the energy in. And more often than not, it happens. So, and this is also what Stephen Greer, that famous UFO guy, you know who Stephen Greer is? He's super into the UFO thing. He's Dr. Stephen Greer. He's been on a number of different documentaries and TV shows. And he charges people to come to his ranch and meditate to see said UFOs. Now, Graham from Grimerica no longer does it because he's like, I'm starting to get the sense that these things aren't all benign or benevolent and that there are some of these things that are showing up giving negative experiences. And so he's like, he got to a point where it was working, but it started freaking him out. So that's why I'm less inclined to think it's what this guy is saying is BS, because this seems to be a theme that's pretty common now, that you can draw the aliens in by group meditation.
I guess I've always just felt like there were these real crop circles that are very elaborate and we couldn't make them. I'm like, can we actually make something that would like trick them to think it? I don't know. Like, do we even have the skills to make this thing that I'm trying to think of an analogy. It feels a little bit egotistical to me. Like, that we have the power to conjure or attract. If they're like interdimensional.
But he's not saying it's our power. I know what you're saying, though. It does sound egotistical, but I think he's saying it, that aliens want to communicate with us, right? And that they're instilling subconsciously these thoughts in their brains of what shapes to draw, where to draw it.
That's why like the mind control sounds more believable to me.
Yeah, I think if it's going one way or the other, it's them controlling him. And he readily admits that's just as likely as them having any impact.
Yeah. I feel like would be if you are going and like having a seance and like conjuring spirits. Like, I don't think you actually conjured them. You probably, that's probably there, and you opened a door.
Well, it's like the vampire thing, right? You have to invite the vampire into your house or they're not allowed in. And so a lot of people think the same thing about demons, that you have to intentionally or unintentionally open up the door, and then it decides if it's going to step through or not. And then as it becomes, like, from what I've heard on these various paranormal shows, right, the entity begins to take more and more control of the situation. So first you might think like you're in control of the genie, but you find out really the genie is in control of you.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, that makes sense. Looks like we're on the same page then.
Yeah, I think we're probably on the same page.
Well, I guess this concludes our three-part triangle series.
I got to say, Bermuda Triangle, I was a little distraught because I didn't do a lot of research. This was yours, but I did read that whole thing about how it doesn't have percentage-wise more missing ships, etc. But I think it did not fail to deliver with the strangeness and high strangeness and oddities.
Awesome. Yeah. It's funny. I have a friend from Bermuda. I'm like, does everybody ask you? It's like the first thing people ask you when you say you're from Bermuda, something about the Bermuda Triangle. Do you get nervous flying back and forth from the U.S.?
What was her answer?
He was really chill about it. He was like, yeah, it's not a big deal. Like it's just normal. Like, it's just a normal place to live.
So we've had a few synchronicities with timing of our episodes, like the fact that this plane from Australia in 78 and then one just happened a month ago. Like, it's yet another synchronicity, Mel.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. All right. Well, excellent. I really feel good about the triangles and the completion and landing on the Bermuda Triangle at the end, I think, was the right call.
Awesome. Yeah. And thank you for prepping the other triangle episodes. So if listeners miss those, definitely check those out as well. And then a brief reminder, this week's winner of my Avalon X Magnesium 8 is Darian Murphy, 200,000. Thank you so much for your review and Apple Podcasts. Please take a screenshot of it and send it to contact@mindblownshow.com. Everybody else can use the coupon code MINDBLOWN to get 10% off site-wide at avalonx.us. And you can help support the show by writing a review in Apple Podcasts. We would love to hear your thoughts and your ideas and all the things. And that will enter you to win a bottle as well. So I think that's all the things. Anything from you, Scott, before we go?
Just want to thank everyone who has done a review. And if you want to share the show, just hit that little triangle, that little square with the arrow above it, and you can share any episode you like with your friends. And that also goes a long way. So if you got a favorite episode, share it with friends and family.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And I will talk to you next week.
Awesome, Mel. Thank you for preparing Bermuda Triangle. Have a great night. Catch you next week.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Mind Blown podcast. Don't worry, your brain can store about 1 million gigabytes of data. That's enough memory to record continuous TV shows for over 300 years. That said, psychology suggests that your memory is actually just your memory of your last memory, leading to a process called memory distortion, where your memories change over time. If you're enjoying the show, remember to subscribe and write a brief review in Apple Podcasts. And definitely let us know what you find most mind-blowing.